Welcome back to the program. We are joined again by Colonel Douglas McGregor, a combat veteran, author, and former senior advisor to the U.S. Secretary of Defense. So welcome back to the program.
Sure, I'm happy to be back. Thanks.
So we see President Putin last week gave a very long speech. I summarized it as Russia looking towards Asia now for economic partners, and efforts to be very optimistic about U.S.-Russia bilateral relations possibly developing, and then, of course, profound pessimism about relations with Europe, and again, using very derogatory language, calling European leaders weirdos at some point. But while there was a lot of efforts to have a benign posture towards the United States, there was also some warnings about sending the Tomahawks, which would be seen as an American attack on Russia. I was wondering how you see this development, because only now we also saw HIMARS being used to attack Belgorod, again, Russian territory, which also is an American weapon, which is assumed to rely on U.S. intelligence in order to pick the targets. Again, I'm not sure if I'm reading that correctly, but how do you see the developments with the Tomahawks? How serious is this?
I think that since President Trump opened his mouth and made the comment that he would supply Tomahawks to the Ukrainians, there's been a reconsideration. You know, President Trump, to be frank, is often reckless with speech. He says things that are not necessarily false, but certainly a little short on being true. And he exaggerates and leads people to frightening conclusions. I think he's somebody who interacts with audiences, and if he and the audience seem to be getting along well, then the rhetoric becomes increasingly hyperbolic. Let's put it that way. I think somebody got to him. I understand that he had a call with President Putin at some point. That may well have had an impact. I don't know. But he clearly had somebody sit him down and explain, you're talking about a missile system with a range of 1,000 miles. It could be fired from aircraft, on the ground, from submarines, surface vessels. So this is a very flexible weapon system that can reach targets deep inside Russia. And we know from experience with the Ukrainians that if you give them these weapons, they will happily attack Russian civilians and civilian infrastructure. I think once that was made clear to him in the Oval Office, he subsequently said, well, you know, we need to know what they want to do with the Tomahawk and where they want to shoot it and so forth and so on. I have the feeling that he's going to back away from that. It may even go away, because I think he recognizes that this is a bridge too far for us. He doesn't want a war with Russia. Remember, when they began talking, that is the Russians and the Americans in Saudi Arabia, they had a very good meeting, but the meeting was focused on normalizing relations between Russia and the United States. If you listen carefully to President Putin, he frequently mentions the areas where he would like to see a resumption of normal trade. And I think President Trump privately feels the same way. Unfortunately, you know, Trump's got himself into a lot of trouble in Ukraine. And not knowing what else to do, in frustration, he's become, or let us say, he's made the transformation to become the new Biden, and has begun repeating stupidities and falsehoods that were common with Biden about what is happening in Ukraine and what could happen. But in reality, and you always have to distinguish what's said from what actually happens. So we can't provide the billions of dollars worth of equipment in a timely manner that would make any difference to what's happening on the battlefield in Ukraine. I think he knows that. The Tomahawk system is sort of a last gasp effort to try and hand something to the Ukrainians that will make a difference. Well, they're not going to make a difference. They could widen the war. They could escalate the war, particularly on the Russian side, and could put us in a difficult position with Russia to the point where we could be dragged into a war we don't want to fight. I think he's figured that out. So my expectation is that the Tomahawk stupidity, it really is a stupid idea, will vanish, will go away. It'll be quietly forgotten.
How are you assessing the Europeans here, though? Because, as I mentioned, there seems to be only contempt these days for Europe in Moscow. And in Europe, though, if you listen to the last speeches of von der Leyen, it's almost a call for war. we shouldn't shy away from retaliating against Russia. And you have a German Chancellor Merz arguing, you know, they have to build this massive army to possibly fight Russia. You have people like Kaja Kallas, you know, once made a point that it would be good if we defeat Russia so they can be broken up into smaller countries. Do you see this as being, how are you assessing the Europeans? Is this panic or, well, obviously they're panicked, but do you see them actually wanting to go to war against Russia, or are they just pumping themselves up for domestic audience, American audience, or Russian audience?
Well, you say Europeans. I prefer to say globalist leadership in places like France, Germany, and Great Britain. Starmer, Macron, and Matz are, let us say, graduates of the Soros school of globalism. They have been doing everything in their power. In fact, their predecessors did as well with Mrs. Merkel to open borders, create unrest and civil disturbance inside their own countries, by inviting people in that could never possibly assimilate. In fact, there's a great deal of evidence they came to assimilate Europeans as opposed to the opposite. So I think that's part of their problem. They're desperate. They know that they've been discovered. Their sins are known publicly. Increasingly, people, particularly in Great Britain and France, I think, have come to terms with the reality that Russia is not coming. There is no massive Russian offensive into Europe, nor is there likely to be. And all they have to do is look at Slovakia, Hungary, and now the Czech Republic. These areas are right in the path of the allegedly onrushing Russian military establishment. And they have categorically rejected this. So I think the time now is one of desperation. And they want to cling to power. How do you cling to power? Well, you continue to insist on this great danger to the East, and you start spending money you don't really have in the hopes that you can pump up the economy, and you're going to do it with military production. I don't think it's going to work. I don't see any future for it. The other thing is, Glenn, to build an effective force that can fight takes about 10 years. It took us 10 years after the Vietnam War to reconstitute our armed forces. And it was a very expensive proposition, but it took a lot of training and several generations of equipment and new generations of soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines. What are the Europeans going to do? How rapidly can they build something up? How rapidly can they train and field anything? That's why I think somebody said that Matz was talking about some sort of production level by 2030 with a force that could use the equipment. I think he's being very, very optimistic. I think it'll take much longer. So I think this is really all about clinging tenaciously to power. And, you know, the futility of this and the stupidity of it is really shocking. And I was reminded of something, I don't think I've ever mentioned him before, but it's somebody I always admired, and that is Oxenstierna. Oxenstierna was, of course, the great high chancellor in Sweden, did a wonderful job under Gustav Adolf, and then subsequently with his daughter Christina. And his son attended a meeting with the king, Gustav Adolf, and he wrote to his father about it, and he said, "I can't believe it." He said, "The king must be mad. His ministers are crazy. These people are going to get us into terrible wars we can't possibly win. None of this is affordable." I mean, literally, you could have lifted it from today, from what we're seeing in Washington, or for that matter, in Paris, London, and Berlin. And Oxenstierna wrote back to his son, "Are you surprised that we are ruled by so little wisdom?" And his point was, why are you surprised? The people that are at the top are not wise. They're not thoughtful. They're self-immersed, self-important, self-absorbed. And they're not thinking in terms of what is in the interests of their people. So I think that's essentially what the Europeans are finding out. As I said, the Germans are taking longer, as usual, to figure this out. But they're figuring it out.
But when you assess a threat, you will look at the capabilities and then intentions. Now, I agree on the capabilities, though. That is that the Europeans don't have what it takes to fight Russia. There's a lot of ambitions about building up a military, the big drone wall. I'm not quite sure what that would actually entail in military sense. They have to flesh out this concept, I think. But in terms of intentions, first I thought, you know, they're just beating their chest here, but on the other hand, they're talking now about intercepting Russian missiles and drones from the Polish territory into Western Ukraine, hoping that the Russians will agree to the new rules that they still can't be targeted. We saw France seize what they thought was a Russian ship, which, if it was, would it be an act of war? I mean, the crazy rhetoric does appear to translate to some extent into crazy policies, though.
I think we have to stand back from these discussions about a drone wall and understand that what they're really talking about effectively is a high-tech Maginot line. We know how well that's worked out in the past. It's a huge waste of money. The second part is, what can you reasonably achieve with the laws of physics right now? And the problem that we have, as long as we cannot break the laws of fractal mathematics and change physics, and that's what you've got to do, until you can create force fields, directed energy force fields, you cannot possibly stop thousands of missiles, thousands of drones. In other words, the offensive strike against you will always overwhelm whatever defensive system you set up. So this high-tech Maginot line is an illusion. That needs to be dropped. It's prohibitively expensive. But here's the other thing. There's no evidence that the Russians want desperately to overwhelm and destroy Europe. This is a different era from, let us say, the age of World War II, or if you go back further, the 30 Years' War. Everyone is very sensitive, I think, to scientific industrial development, to infrastructure, to productivity. What's the point of fighting a war ostensibly for territory and people if you're going to destroy everything in the process? It doesn't make a lot of sense. So I just don't see any evidence that the Russians want to put their own infrastructure at risk, let alone destroy everybody else's. So I think there's a lot of nonsense on the street right now, and people are searching for answers, but they're coming up, unfortunately, with the same old ones. We have the same problem here with the so-called Golden Dome. The Golden Dome is, a large money pit into which people will throw hundreds of billions of dollars. The only people interested in it are, of course, the defense industries. And obviously, there are universities with physics departments and elsewhere that are looking forward to many wonderful grants, all of which are being asked to solve a problem they can't possibly solve. So it's a waste of time, money, and resources. But look how appealing it is. So much so that, you know, the supporters of President Trump, if you bring it up, they'll say, well, you're negative. You're just being negative. This is important for us. Well, sure, it's important, but you can't achieve it. You can't build it. It won't work. That has a role to play. I think the Europeans and we are all in the same boat there.
Yeah, the whole idea of Russia annexing Poland or marching on Paris, it's really lunatic stuff. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. This is what we're talking about. No one actually explains this idea. It's like, to what end? What would be the purpose? And also, under what circumstances would the Russians want to have the resources to both the material as well as public support and from friendly countries to, like, to occupy a country of 40 million people, where not one single one wants to actually be under Russian rule, is really beyond absurd. But I did want to ask you about the patience, which might be running thin in Moscow, because I get there's a more or increasing pressure within the Kremlin on the president that they think this might be going too slowly. I mean, you can Putin tried to explain it during his the Valdai meeting. He was going through the numbers. This is how many people they're losing. They're losing more and more. They're able to recruit fewer and fewer. They can't replenish. their losses. So, you know, this is just about math. Without soldiers, there won't be an army. Without an army, there won't be a war. But at the same time, the longer this war drags on, not only more casualties are inflicted, but also the more likely that the Europeans or others could be pulled in to a wider war. So some are asking, why not a decapitation strike? And I failed myself to answer that question properly, so I thought I would pass it on to you. Well, why do you think they haven't tried to do the same as, for example, the Americans tried to do against Iran?
And I think we will try something similar, unfortunately, in Venezuela in the near future. But those kinds of strikes haven't turned out very well for us. We haven't been able to make them work. We tried to do that in Iraq several times. It did not work. So I think the whole notion of regime change based on a decapitation strike is an illusion. So the people that argue for that sort of thing, unless they're prepared to see all of Kiev vanish or vaporized in some sort of terrible cloud of fuel air explosive, I don't see that it makes much sense. I think we have to understand a couple of things about President Putin. By the way, I don't claim to be an expert on President Putin. I don't even claim to be an expert on Russia. But I think I can understand to some extent his preeminent concern. And from the very first moment, his preeminent concern was to avoid a war with the United States and NATO. He didn't want that. He's always been able to see far beyond the present and understand there are long-term interests, strategic interests, that Russia wants to protect. He doesn't want Russia to be destroyed in some pointless nuclear exchange any more than I think President Trump, however confused and sometimes grandiose he may be and how often he bloviates, I don't see any evidence that President Trump wants to risk a nuclear escalation and exchange either. So I think if you understand that about President Putin, I think he said, we're going to win this, we're going to destroy this enemy, we're going to be successful, but we're not going to hand our potential opponents, our critics, our enemies on a silver platter an excuse to intervene in this against us, to rush in and say, see, the evil Russians are now marching at high speed towards Lvov in Western Ukraine. So he has avoided taking actions that would precipitate any kind of really dramatic response. In the meantime, to the credit of the Russians, they have managed to defeat the technologies of war that we have handed the Ukrainians. Now, you can blame some of that on the Ukrainians who may not know what they're doing, but looks an awful lot to me as though they've been taking orders and advice from the people at the top of NATO. That has turned out to be disastrous. And everything that we have encouraged them to do has failed miserably, and they have taken terrible losses as a result. So I think at this point, he's going to continue to try and exercise a certain amount of patience and restraint because of the reasons that we discussed earlier. I think he expects these governments to tumble in London, in Paris, and ultimately in Berlin. The question is who goes first, and it looks like Macron it might win the first prize for going under along with his government. That would be a game changer because here's an old expression. I think it was Metternich who said so. When Paris sneezes, Europe catches a cold. I think France is probably going to lead Europe in a new direction by removing Macron and the people running the show in France. And I think years of turmoil will ensue, and I'm sure the French army is going to have lots to do right there at home in France. And, you know, there's something else that we don't understand. Somebody pointed this out to me today, and I think they're right. The defense budget or the military budget for Algeria is larger than the military budget for France. So that's a rather striking comparison. We usually think of the French and the Algerians in this colonial relationship, but that's misleading. And I think that reflects a broader change around the world. At some point, all of these small states in Europe with Lilliputian armies are going to be seen as what they are, not terribly relevant.
Yeah, this is Europe exhausting itself is at such a fast rate, not just economic, but militarily as well. It is quite shocking how quickly things are changing. I also want to ask you about what you see happening on the battlefield in Ukraine, because I guess another thing about Putin at the Valdai meeting, he seemed very confident and a bit cheerful. I never seen him, do this many jokes in one sitting. It was quite unusual. He doesn't seem like someone who fears that Russia is on its last leg. On the contrary, you get also where the optimism grows in Russia, you also see from the Ukrainian leadership as well as from their Telegram channels that the pessimism is now setting in. What do you see happening on the front line, though, and how critical do you think it could be?
I think the Ukrainian forces have been deteriorating and decaying now for many months. I'm sure they are hopelessly demoralized. Unofficial polling data, in other words, opinion polls that were collected on the ground in Ukraine, that is the part of Ukraine that's not in war and not actively being attacked, is all very negative on the war. Their view is it's time to throw in the towel on this. This is suicidal. We've got to live in the future. The future is not going to be the one that Zelensky talks about. And the question is, where do we end up? Some people are saying we're going to end up in some sort of relationship with Russia, and that's probably a good thing because it will prevent future wars. I mean, that's the kind of thing you're getting from Ukrainians. On the other hand, there are other people are saying, well, we have to accept neutrality. It's a very small number of people who are clinging to this notion that Ukraine must be part of the NATO and the EU. I was a little surprised that President Putin responded to somebody who asked him whether or not Ukraine could join the European Union, and he indicated, well, I guess that's a possibility. I find that quite incredible. But it was interesting that he would say that. Perhaps that's another reflection of his optimism with regard to what's happening on the battlefield. But the losses are terrific. Anyone who stands their ground and wants to oppose the Russians is sort of quietly encircled and then systematically annihilated, for the most part with long-range strike, at which point in time, as soon as the strikes are lifted, in come Russian forces, leading with both very highly skilled infantry infiltrators, lots of drones, and hugely powerful firepower. In other words, directed, accurate, devastating firepower in the direct mode. This war is for all intents and purposes, at an end, except people are still being shoved in front of the Russians. Now, the other question is, why don't they just rush forward? Well, look at the map. Where they are now, the population speaks Russian, is culturally Russian. Most of them consider themselves to be Russian. I don't think there's much enthusiasm in Moscow for ruling over large numbers of Ukrainians who are fiercely Ukrainian in every sense of the word. They'd rather not do that. They just want them to be neutral and not a springboard for attack against Russia via NATO. That's all. So can that be resolved? Well, the problem is that the one man that could have delivered some measure of success is Donald Trump. And he decided that since there was no Nobel Prize in this for him, that he would abdicate his responsibility for the whole thing to the Europeans. Fine. We'll give you what you want. You do what you want. And he's turning his attention to the Middle East and now, I guess, Venezuela.
Yeah, on that topic, though, because I did also want to ask you about what is happening in the Middle East. That is, he has advanced this, we call it a peace proposal, but it's more or less accepted or we'll destroy you. It's called forgot the term, eternal peace agreement or something along those lines. He likes the bombastic language. This is, I'm not sure if he's overselling the eternal peace, but what do you make of this 20-point agreement?
Not much. It reminds me of some of the agreements made between the old Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth and the Russians, treaties that, by the way, had similar titles. You know, the Treaty of Eternal Peace and Tranquility and Goodwill Forever and Ever and Ever between you know, the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth and the Tsar of Russia and so forth. It's all nonsense. If you look at the 21 points, again, you have to distinguish between wishful thinking and action. What is Mr. Netanyahu doing and what does he continue to do? He continues to attack and strike and bomb at will. I see no evidence that he's prepared to back off. Would he withdraw some forces from parts of the Gaza Strip? Perhaps. But he's absolutely not going to turn the Gaza Strip over to an Arab force of any kind. This is one of the reasons that I think the Egyptians are trying to find a way to drag us in. And I can't think of anything more wasteful and stupid than for us to become involved in that conflict. It's absolutely unrewarding for us. We simply end up being everybody's enemy and a target for everybody. That's, by the way, what happened to us in Lebanon in 1982. So I don't know what people are thinking. I think people are taking what President Trump says at face value. I just don't see any evidence that it has a snowball's chance in hell of happening.
But if, for some reason, the Hamas would accept this, what would this entail? Do they have to give up all their weapons? They have to give up their tunnels? They have to give up the hostages? And then hope that without any defense, Israel and its Western backers will show them some mercy? Or what are there any guarantees there for the Israelis? I know there's not to mention any state in there, but is it clear that the Israelis will pull back from their territory? I mean, what actually is in there for the Palestinians?
Not much, as far as I can tell. You're right. What they're expecting Hamas to do is to show up unarmed, line up in neatly organized rows, get down on their knees, beg forgiveness, and hope for the best. I don't see much evidence for that happening. And again, you know, the Israelis continue to drop these leaflets everywhere, telling the population, leave or you will be killed. That's essentially what they're telling the people in Gaza, and I think that message is coming through increasingly on the West Bank. It was interesting to watch President Trump say, I would not allow the annexation of the West Bank. Well, whatever he says is irrelevant. It's going to happen. Most people think it's already happened. It's a de facto outcome. His backers, the people that elected him, that paid for his term in the White House and control Congress, want those things to happen. They're going to happen, unless Israel is destroyed in a future war or conflict. And of course, that brings us to Iran. Could that happen against Iran? I don't know. But I think we're going to go through another round of war with Iran. There's no question about that.
Well, Netanyahu recently gave a speech where he pointed out that Iran now poses a nuclear threat to the United States. And yeah, I know it's not a very original accusation to make, but Trump also warned of possible new strikes against Iran if it revives its nuclear work, which I guess undermines the former claim that he completely obliterated the nuclear program of Iran. But do you see a pathway to a war in the foreseeable future, though? Or because the Americans did move a lot of their weapon infrastructure, their weaponry, their refueling tankers, all of this down to the region, as you and I spoke about in the past. Do you see this, do you see it sitting there, or do you see, I'm not sure what indicators we should look for if there is preparations for a war?
Well, you've already pointed to the most important ones. The movement of people, ammunition in the form of missiles, rockets, fuel, and other things, refueling assets, jet aircraft, all of that is moved into the region, the Eastern Mediterranean, the Red Sea. So I fully expect something to happen in the near future. What's the trigger? I don't know. People say, well, it could be a false flag. I don't think it matters very much. I think Mr. Netanyahu knows that he has really a limited opportunity and time to strike and be successful. The whole Greater Israel project is actually hanging in the balance. Things haven't gone very well in Gaza. The anticipated time in Gaza was less than 6 months. Here we are 2 years later. So he's got serious problems on his hands. His economy is destroyed, but it doesn't matter very much since we're pouring billions into Israel to keep the economy going. I think, though, he's worried about the turn of public opinion in the United States against Israel and support for Israel. And his fear is not today, but in the future. Therefore, you've got to act sooner rather than later to achieve your goals. So I think he's got to attack. I thought that he would have attacked by the end of September, certainly by the middle of October. We'll see. It could be pushed further into November. It all depends on the readiness indicators. When I say readiness, aircraft, personnel, people, ammunition, fuel, positioning, ships, everything. All of those things had to be taken into account. I don't have a detailed description of that. And if I did, I wouldn't give it to you anyway, because I'm an American and I still want Americans to come through this with as few as casualties and losses as possible, whether or not I support the policy. So more than that, I cannot say, but I think it's coming, and I think it's coming soon.
But I guess the advantage the first time around was this surprise attack, because the Iranians thought they were in the middle of negotiations. They were told they were, you know, making advancements, that peace was around the corner. And of course, there's also other elements of surprise, for example, jamming of their air defense systems. How, in the absence of this element of surprise, what do you think could be in Israel's advantage to play this different this time around? Do they have more intelligence now on where the tunnels where the Iranians store their missiles? Are they going to use proxies? I mean, do we know anything how, given that it didn't end well last time, how will the Israelis play it differently this time?
Well, again, you're asking important questions. I don't know the precise answers. I think they have no doubt kept Iran under persistent surveillance. And to the extent that they could introduce people from Azerbaijan or Syria or Iraq or somewhere else into Iran, or from Afghanistan for that matter, to find answers to these questions, I'm sure they've done it. Will that make any difference? I don't know. I know that the Russians have now weighed in pretty dramatically to assist with integrated air defenses. Most of that is technical expertise, but some of it also involves equipment and missiles. Iran is certainly stronger now, more cohesive as a society, more capable than it was the last time around. It's also interesting that we've seen articles in the Russian press and also in Azerbaijan and elsewhere that the so-called religious police in Iran will no longer stop women who fail to wear the proper headgear or veil themselves or anything else. In other words, the relaxations of the restrictions that are associated with that Islamist or Islamic revolution are beginning to vanish officially. They've already been dramatically reduced. The population simply rejected it. And I think they now see the wisdom of dumping most of that because it inhibits cooperation. It weakens national unity. So in that sense, I guess you could argue that the attacks on Iran have actually improved life inside Iran dramatically in a purely human sense for the men and women that live there. And they've certainly given everybody a reason to cooperate. I don't see any evidence that there's a willingness of the Azeri Turks, who are Shiites up in northwestern Iran, to revolt against Iran. Not at all. So the assumptions that were there before about the weakness of Iran and how the right decapitation strike would bring chaos, I think they've had to drop those. Now, what does that mean? Does it mean that after they've unleashed this war, if things don't go well, they'll turn to the use of a nuclear weapon? I don't know, but that's something I worry about. Worry a great deal that they will do that. And if that were to happen, that would be catastrophic for them and for the region.
Yeah, it was the religious laws. They were already getting kind of relaxed. I wasn't sure how the war would affect it, but I was in Tehran with Max Blumenthal and Alistair Crook back in May for this conference. That was one of the things that surprised me, because, again, I haven't been following what's been happening since the revolution in 79, but I was surprised by what a significant portion of the women walk around without headscarves or, you know, just walking around in jeans and t-shirt or anything, without anything on their heads. So this was, it took me a bit by surprise, because this was one of the reasons why we should support a strike on Iran, that, you know, they have to wear a head. I'm not sure how they put two and two together on this one, but it is interesting, because usually once a country is under attack, this is when a government tightens its control over society. So I didn't know that had gone the other way.
Depending on what kind of control you're talking about, if you can improve the lives of your citizens, you can give them personal freedom, the right to think and behave as they see fit, but at the same time, improve your security to prevent the Israelis from buying up traitors and using them against the country. That's a different thing. In other words, it depends on what you're trying to achieve. I think the leadership of Iran is trying to achieve modernization, and it is trying to demonstrate tolerance towards its own people and demonstrate to them conclusively it's in their interest to fight for Iran. And I think that's what the population has decided.
Yeah, my last question was, what are you referring to earlier, the Venezuela? That is, many people around the world are watching this a bit perplexed. They see this small boats off the coast of Venezuela, pretty far away from the United States, being bombed, accused of being narco traffickers. We see the U.S. building up, I'm not sure if it's heavy, but at least building up military capabilities along the coast of Venezuela, which is seemingly not powerful enough for an invasion, but powerful enough for a decapitation strike. Again, I'm not a military man like yourself, so I would like to ask you how are you assessing the situation?
The president has suspended any further diplomatic relations with Venezuela, so that's a rather ominous action. It suggests that some form of action against Venezuela is imminent. There are people walking around Washington saying that they're interested in working with people in Washington to put together plans for the post-war Venezuelan society. That indicates to me that it's quite serious. Now, as I've said to people before, Venezuela is not a narco state. Our interests in Venezuela are largely resource-driven. We're interested in the largest reserves of oil in the world, gas. They also have emerald mines, which are very important for industrial purposes, as well as gold mines. I don't think the narcotics bit is very large. In fact, everybody tells me, who is an expert in the area, that the narcotics continue to come out of Colombia and then find their way north to us, and most of those go via the Pacific. The other thing is that if you're looking for a narco state, an organized crime state, it's Mexico. Mexico is, for all intents and purposes, by our standards in the West, a failed state. That's why it poses a great danger to us from Central America. That's why it was a criminal neglect, if you want to be kind, on the part of President Biden to open our borders. They opened the floodgates, and we have millions of people inside the country. We don't know much about them. Many of them have committed terrible crimes. Now, of course, you have people out there saying, well, here's this lovely young woman, Lakin Riley, who was brutally raped, murdered, whatever, by a Venezuelan criminal, and talked about the Venezuelan gangs. Well, the answer to saving Lakin Riley's life was to keep the borders closed, to police them effectively, to control who comes into the United States, and to enforce the law inside our country. Bombing Venezuela, invading Venezuela, is not going to be a solution to that problem. But again, it's not popular to suggest that our problems are largely domestic. The drug problem resides here inside the United States. Attacking and destroying other countries isn't going to solve that. But that's not popular right now. There are a lot of people who think, well, yes, that's right. Now we need to focus on the Western Hemisphere. I'm agreed on that. I think we should be much more interested in what happens in our hemisphere. I'm just not interested in attacking everybody south of the border.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, though, that some pressure seemed to have been alleviated against Venezuela when when the Russians invaded the Ukraine and the sanctions were imposed on Russia, there was an effort to say, well, Venezuela is not so bad after all. You know, now we can work with them because we needed some other sources of oil. But now, of course, this has turned again and they seem to be targeted. But what would be the possible consequence here, though? Because you do see if there's an attack on Venezuela, destabilizes, that would create further refugees flooding the American borders. It would, wouldn't this exacerbate the problem already?
Well, I'm more concerned about what happens if we physically go in on the ground, which appears to be part of the plan. I think this probably assumes some sort of successful decapitation strike. And the ability of intelligence agencies like the CIA to foment internal unrest and revolt. I'm concerned that this would become a cause celeb for everybody in Latin America. You know, Venezuela has a 1,370-mile border with Colombia. It has a 1,379-mile border with Brazil. It has 1,700 miles of coastline. This is enormous. This is almost France and Germany together. And you have plenty of people in other states in South America, certainly large numbers of so-called paramilitaries in Brazil, or for that matter in Colombia, that could pour into Venezuela with the goal of helping them fight us. So I think it could turn into a terrible morass. It could become overnight, instantly, a failed state that then represents a permanent threat to us in North America. It'll be much worse than anything we could have imagined was there already. But then again, that's my private opinion, which again says, what do we achieve and what do we gain by going in there? And my answer is nothing on both counts. And again, back to the statement, control your borders, enforce the law, and deal with the illegal problem that we have and our drug problem at home. That's what we ought to be doing, not attacking and invading other people's countries.
Yeah, Trump seems to have deviated significantly from this America First. He didn't mention invading Venezuela, at least in his campaign speeches. But
he's transformed into Joe Biden. And how long has he been in office? And this tends to also reinforce the wisdom of Putin's statement some time ago. He said, having dealt with many presidents, I find that at the end of the day, they all end up doing the same thing. Or as somebody else put it, it doesn't matter who you vote for, you get someone like John McCain.
Well, he does seem to be looking more like John McCain every day. So anyways, thank you again for your being so generous with your time. And I hope to have you back on soon. Thank you.
Sure. Thanks, Glenn. Bye-bye.